How about this? Okay, great. All right. So, James and I live on a street in Berkeley with very modest houses and wonderful big trees and a really friendly neighborhood. Many of the people have lived there, like us, for decades. Every once in a while, we have a block party where we block off the two ends of the street, and we have a big potluck, and all sorts of people come out for it. And one of the people, I like them all, one of them I'm very fond of is Eleanor. Eleanor is about 97 now, and she lives two doors up, and she's still highly functional. She still drives her car to the store, and she gets herself to Mass on Sunday, and she's very friendly. And she climbs the stairs every night because she prefers to sleep in the bed that she and her deceased husband always slept in. So I was walking her home one night, and I said, "Eleanor, how do you do it?" And she said, "Honey, it's all about good habits." So that's what we're developing here. And I think forgiveness, which I want to talk to you about tonight, is one of the best habits that we can develop. Forgiveness is a resilience habit. It's a happiness intervention. And really, when it comes down to it, there's no way to sit fully in the present with love if we're carrying around a story of how someone did us wrong, or how we've treated others in a way that makes us unlovable, or how we're fundamentally flawed. So we may think that forgiveness is about the past or about someone else, but forgiveness really is about ourselves right in the present. We forgive basically for our own peace of mind. In the Buddhist teachings, there's the story of about when you hold a grudge, it's like drinking poison and hoping the other will die, or holding on to a hot burning coal and thinking that you are hurting the other person because you're poised to throw it at them, but really it's hurting yourself. Is this still going? Sorry. Great. Okay. So put this around. Okay. So all the research confirms that forgiveness is really good for ourselves. It's very good. It's been documented medically. It's very good for our health. It's really good for our relationship with others. And fundamentally, it's absolutely critical for our relationship with ourself. And so tonight I want to talk to you about the different steps on the path to forgiveness. And the very first step is the recognition that suffering is universal. We live in an individualistic, competitive American culture, and we may believe that if we really do it right, we somehow won't suffer. And the corollary to that is, if we're suffering, we must have done something wrong. And I became poignantly aware of this. I've taught five 8-week courses on mindful self-compassion as a volunteer, just giving my time at the Women's Cancer Resource Center. And it's a really, I find, very wonderful group to work with. They're very present. They're very committed. They really, really want to feel better. But the thing that I found the saddest is here are people who have gotten sick, and because they're sick, often they can't work. They're doing chemotherapy, which makes them feel really lousy. This is a women's center, so Generally, their appearance changes. If nothing more, their vitality changes a lot. So they start feeling lousy about themselves because we have such an emphasis in our culture about how you look. And they're not earning money or as much money as they used to. And they just generally feel lousy. And the saddest part is that there's this undercurrent, well, if I would have only, fill in the blank, eaten more broccoli or whatever, then I wouldn't be dealing with this. Which is really sad, because actually, despite all the advertisement, if you just buy this or do that, we will, if you are alive today, you will either die young or you will experience old age, sickness, and death. That is a universal law. We all experience disappointment, betrayal, and broken trust. And when we really know that this pain is universal, that we're not bad because we're experiencing it, and it really just means we're alive, then when we really get that, then we can experience some ease and perspective about things. I spent years disturbed by things that were unfair. I thought the world was unfair. I saw all sorts of examples of injustice. And so it was difficult for me to forgive life. And it was I was kind of on the lookout when I was treated unfairly. And then I finally got it. Life is not fair. It just isn't. It truly isn't. I mean, what is fair about, I can walk into the dining hall and my big decision is how big a portion I'm going to take, when some other parent's big decision is which child they're going to feed. Or I can prefer to drink purified water, and somebody else is walking a long ways carrying a jug of polluted water. So there's really, once I got over life should be fair, it was somehow easier. And Frank Ostasevsky, who teaches here with James in the Heavenly Messengers program and is one of the leading authorities really on death and dying, and has written a book, The Five Invitations, says that one of the attitudes that causes people, especially when they're dying, but anybody, the most suffering is the attitude of, this isn't the way life's supposed to be. So when we carry that attitude, we suffer, guaranteed. And I talked a little bit the other day about acceptance, and I want to really underscore that acceptance of conditions does not mean that we agree with them. Hopefully, we will still work for justice, but we can't really make changes until we first accept the truth of what is actually happening with our feet on the ground and our eyes wide open. So this acceptance does not in any way condone passivity. It actually just frees our life energy up to get on with the work that's needed. Bhikkhu Bodhi is the premier translator of the Buddhist texts. He's a tremendously brilliant man and has written many Buddhist texts, which people all over the world turn to. I mean, he's translated them from ancient language, but he's also the founder of Buddhist Global Relief, which works to create long-term solutions in the realm of hunger, poverty, and injustice. So it's important that we really get that, that we, instead of railing against the way life is, that we just say, okay, this is the situation. Now, what can I do about it to give back? And we still can have that niggling idea. Well, if I only arrange the right conditions, I'll be more happy. Maybe if I play by the rules and I'm very disciplined, I meditate more, I read James's Awakening Joy book, and I do all the 10 steps, and I don't watch the news at night, then I won't suffer. And it's fine. It's great to make intentions. It really is good. But we have to just come to terms with the fact that we don't control life. So I wanted to talk to you tonight about the steps of forgiveness. First of all, forgiveness is a process. We can't will forgiveness to happen. You may have already tried that and then have been surprised when 3 months later you get re-stimulated and you're still angry about the same thing that you thought you forgave. And perhaps the reason you wanted to forgive it is you didn't want to be bugged by it anymore. And I can totally understand that, and I've tried that myself, I have to admit. But it doesn't work. You can't just say, I'm okay, I'm going to force myself to forgive, and it's over. Because it's a process. And so rather than willing ourselves, it's more about being willing to forgive, saying, okay, it's my intention. I want to forgive. I set the intention of my heart. Its intention becomes the compass of my heart and my psyche. And then with that intention, I will meet all the obstacles which arise with fully with that intention. So maybe we would say, instead of I forgive, maybe we'd say, may I begin to forgive myself? May I begin to forgive another? Or may I learn to forgive myself or another? And it's really good with any of these happiness interventions or practices to practice little and often. It's so much easier to pick up the 2-pound weight and keep lifting. And pretty soon, that's such a breeze and you can go for the 4-pounder. So practice when you don't get the right parking place, you know? Or when somebody says something a little nasty, or you hear some news and you're like, eh. You know, start practicing. Don't wait until you've been, you know, really betrayed to start practicing forgiveness. It's a wonderful habit and practice just to enjoy your life with more. So you have the intention to forgive, and along with that goes the commitment to yourself to do what you have to do to feel better. Because remember, forgiveness is mainly for you. So Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who's the architect of the healing process in post-apartheid South Africa, puts it this way. Forgiveness is the highest form of self-interest. I need to forgive so that my anger and lust for revenge does not corrode my own being. So here on retreat, we're basically in such a solitary process. We come across what's often referred to as the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. But I would say when you leave here, if there are still things that you have come up and you notice that you can't forgive them or yourself, it's really important that you don't keep this grief to yourself. That research has shown that you really need to share it with another person. So the human connection is central to healing. That's what one of the really wonderful things about a good therapist. You can go and tell them your worst thoughts and your terrible misdeeds, and they still love you. And I suggest that you do that with your friends. You're really, you know, to be wise discernment. Who can you trust that you can go and tell the things that are being on your mind, and they say, okay, you know, I got it, and I know how painful that is. And they're really with you. But you feel connected and heard and not so isolated. Anne Lamott says, "My mind is like a bad neighborhood. I try not to go there alone." So another part of the process is to know what forgiveness is and what it's not. Forgiveness is not condoning, it's not pardoning, it's not forgetting, it's not false reconciliation, it's not appeasement, it's not sentimentality, and it doesn't even mean that we ever have to see the person again who betrayed us. But forgiveness is an inner peace, and it's a wise perspective that allows us to live in the present with love. It allows us to continue to keep our hearts open, even when we face hostility, injustice, sorrow, hurt, and grief. And it's sometimes helpful to realize that our primary suffering is not coming from what happened 10 years ago. It's coming from how we're dealing with it right now. So the next step, believe it or not, is the step to practice stress management. That's actually to soothe the body's fight or flight response. Fred Luskin is the director of the Stanford University Forgiveness Project, and he says that the great mistake that people make about forgiveness is we ask that part of us, ourselves, that's filled with adrenaline, that's filled with the fight or flight hormone, what to do about the situation. Now, adrenaline is great for lifting a car off a child, but it also ensures that we have a really narrow ability to think. So when we've been harmed, we lose the sense that the world is a safe, sane, orderly place. And this is the time to recenter ourselves. This could mean just if it's a quick thing or you've been practicing a lot, it could just mean taking some breaths, some deep breaths. It could mean taking a walk outside, sort of a sense and savor walk. Or it could be remembering the people and places, situations that you're really grateful for. That can interrupt the flow of da-da-da-da-da-da. It can be remembering times of kindness. Just even thinking about the day, remembering who was kind to you today. It can remember feeling cherished by your grandmother or your dog or whomever. And it can be cherishing. Who do you cherish? All you're trying to do is change the channel here. Because if you're in the middle of the story and you're really, all the stress hormones are pumping in your body, you're really not capable of forgiving. So even though it sounds like it's some kind of bypass, you're still going to deal with forgiveness. You're just laying the right conditions for it. So the next step is actually opening to pain. So now that we've got ourselves in a little bit more relaxed, open, centered, receptive place, as the poet Rumi says, don't reject your fear and your loneliness. Let it season you like few ingredients can. So first, since we're such a mental culture, usually we first start with the thoughts. And again, Fred Luskin says, it's not what actually happened, it's how we tell the story. And when that story makes an enemy in any way, it creates this painful, restricted body, arousing our uptightness. I hate what I did. I hate what you did. I hate what the president did. I hate what the world is doing. And when we're devastated, we have this tendency to really milk our stories. And can you believe this? We go on and on. And we look for the most disturbing parts of it. And actually, though, most of our stories are reruns. You know, not that many of our thoughts are that new. But when we become aware of our story and see it just as that, only as our story, then sometimes that alone can release the pattern. However, if it's a grudge, it goes back and forth, but it doesn't go anywhere, especially when it stars me as the victim. So often the story is about, I'm not enough. I'm not smart enough, I'm not thin enough, I'm not young enough, I'm not kind enough, I'm not spiritual enough, whatever. And we all have our versions of that. So I was just wondering if you look for yourself for a moment, how many people here have had to deal with that they'd somehow feel, I'm not enough, I don't measure up. Doesn't mean it's all constant, but look around you. You're in an incredible array of very talented, skilled people who all suffer from the same thing. I'm not enough. And we have such high, unreasonable standards for ourselves that demanding perfection, we do that in a way that we would never ask that of a friend. We are so much more compassionate to our friends usually than we are to ourselves. So in looking at the thoughts about the story, we often get into rumination. Repeated thoughts going over and over, same thing. And that can be a signal that there's some kind of unacknowledged emotion or feeling underneath the rumination. These are feelings that we don't acknowledge, and so that story keeps coming back to haunt us. So it's really important that we look and say, how does that story feel in the body? I know for me, it's often a clenched jaw. You know? It's like I'm going to bite someone or really get back, right? My husband will say, you're clenching your jaw again. So for somebody else, it can be a different thing. It can be pain in the chest. It can be, often we have the hard feelings, the anger, the you're doing it to me, and underneath those are the much softer feelings. Underneath the anger, it could be, oh, I don't feel like I'm being seen or being heard, or I don't feel good enough, and I want you to tell me I'm good enough because I don't feel it, you know? And then that can build up a whole deal. But actually, if I don't feel I'm good enough, I'm the only one that can solve that. And so to go around mad at the world because they're not telling me that, it really doesn't do me any good. So part of that is turning towards the feelings in our body, noticing the areas where we're tight, and see if we can soften with them, really relax. If not soften completely, kind of like a pancake, just soften around the edges, you know, just lifting up a little here and a little there, and just feeling, feeling into it. And the hardest thing, actually, Luskin says that until we can feel the grief, we really can't get over. We really can't forgive until we can get down there and feel that distress, that deep disturbance. So what we want to do is actually soften to the feelings and then soothe ourselves. And sometimes Thich Nhat Hanh would say, the Vietnamese Zen master would say, "Oh, that's okay, darling," you know, or something like that. I might just kind of go, "Hey, Jane, you're having a hard day, you know, it's okay." But to really, whatever words do it for you, it might be your grandmother's words. Actually, my husband tells of a practice of stroking his cheek like his grandmother used to do. "Ah, that's okay, dear. It's really all right." So it's kind of whatever way does it for you. Some people do it with touch. Often we do it with putting our hands on our hearts. "Oh, it's okay. Ah, this is so difficult to feel." And yet, just turning toward the pain and feeling it, "Oh, I feel so sad." When we name it, the actual naming of it doesn't feel sad. The naming of it is sort of the adult in charge. You know, just it's not the emotional one. So it can be your own internal figure just saying, "Oh yeah, that's sad. Oh, I'm with you." And then as we allow, you know, there's a thought that as that all of us will have pain, but that the pain grows significantly when we resist it. Then we really even suffer much more. But as we learn to allow the pain does not last as long, nearly as long as when we are completely resisting it and staying just in our thoughts going round and round. So as we allow it, we strengthen our capacity for tears and joy and learn how to listen really deeply to ourselves, like we've longed for our partner to listen to us. And we allow that space of awareness, and we come to trust that space in ourselves. So remember the self-compassion break, because it's really a tool for you where you can put your hand on your heart and acknowledge that this is suffering, and then remember that all beings suffer, everyone suffers, and then having the intention to be kind to yourself. It's a really simple practice. You could practice it many times during a day. So that's another step, really turning toward the pain, not away from it. It's sort of like when I was young, I was once caught in a riptide, and I didn't even know what a riptide was. I was 13 years old. I was a competitive swimmer. I was out playing in the ocean, and I had been trained. My parents said, "Don't go too past the breakers." I loved to ride the breakers, and I got caught in this riptide. And what saved my life was, first I started screaming for help, but there were no lifeguards because it was early in the spring. And then what saved my life was going with it, total surrender, just poof. And then, as you know, riptides are like rivers. They just drag you out, but eventually you swim to the side. But that's sometimes what it feels like, a riptide, when we're caught in these really yucky emotions. We don't know where they're going. They're so powerful. We don't have control over them. But if we can really surrender to them and let them go, they don't last that long. And there is always, especially if you've dealt with trauma, major trauma in your life, I'm not saying drill deep. I'm saying you can back off. You can say, "Okay, enough for now. I'm going for a walk. My work isn't entirely over, but this is going to be a process. This isn't going to be finished up in the next hour or two." So that's a major step of turning toward the pain. It's also, those of you who grew up driving in snow, you learned that if you're going into a skid, you turn into the skid, not away from it. That is what will get you out of the skid. And it's the same way with pain, opening to emotional pain, and that pain that's always there when we have a story and a grudge and we can't let go of it. So underneath that is understanding. That's the next step. Because we've gone through all of this, we've soothed ourselves, we've looked at our thoughts, we've looked at our stories, our emotions, our body. And underneath that is the understanding. Often, we don't have all the facts. And we're reacting on our facts alone. So I wanted to tell you a story about the lieutenant and the cashier. So with mindfulness, we can awaken from delusion. And even the U.S. Army uses mindfulness. They teach mindfulness-based stress reduction based on Jon Kabat-Zinn. And they've had a lot of success with it. And so one young Army officer who had a really hot temper and a history of anger problems was ordered by his colonel to attend an 8-week MBSR class. They were hoping he could reduce his level of stress. And so one day, after attending the class for some weeks, he has stopped for groceries on the way home. It was hot, it was muggy, he was tired, he was not in a good mood. And so he took his car to the checkout lines, and he noticed a woman in front of him had only one item. And she wondered, what on earth is she doing in my line? She should be in the express line. But, what to do? So she was carrying a baby. And when she got up to the cashier, she started talking to the baby. Talking to the cashier. And then he became really irritated. And then, to top it off, the cashier picked up the baby for a moment and went, "Oh, you cute little thing, and then passed the baby back, and he was just livid. But because he'd been practicing mindfulness, he felt it in his body, and he noticed, yes, I'm really angry, and then he could feel the pain rising, he had heat, he had tension and tightness, and he started breathing and relaxing, and finally he saw this little boy smiling. And so when he reached the cashier, he said, "Oh, that was a cute little boy." You know, he was feeling proud of himself that he didn't say any of the things he typically would. And she said, "Oh, do you like him? That was my baby. His father was in the Air Force, but he was killed last winter. So now I have to work full time, and my mom brings him in twice a day so I can say hi." So understanding is really key. We often don't know the full story. And we just need to see the bigger pictures and know that we all do make mistakes, that we shouldn't. Because every thought and every action is a product of these invisible causes in the universe that are stretched back totally through time and outward across the planet. We've all inherited our temperaments from our grandparents and our parents, and we were so influenced by what happened in our early childhood, what was our birth order, how were our parents doing when we were little, what was our diet, what was our culture, we're influenced by how much sleep we happen to get today, or what the current events are going on. There's just a multitude of stresses and causes and things that are causing people to be more apt to act a certain way. And as James writes in Awakening Joy, he says, "I once saw a poster that conveyed this point in heartbreaking terms. The picture was of a sad-looking boy, was the backdrop for a statistic that said a child raised in the home with domestic violence is 700 times more likely to become involved in domestic violence as an adult." So when we recognize that every action has a cause, which is itself part of a long chain of cause and effect, then we can have a lot more compassion for ourselves and for everything else that arises. And we need to recognize that all human beings are struggling with the issues of greed, hatred, and confusion. And you've probably seen a bit of that for yourself here, since you've been here. So I wanted to read a poem to you by Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master. And I know a number of you probably have heard this poem probably more than once, but I really love it. And so I just ask you to listen to it from the depth of your stillness. It's called Call Me By My True Names. Do not say that I'll depart tomorrow, because even today I still arrive. Look deeply. I arrive in every second to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird with wings still fragile, learning to sing in my own new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, in order to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and the death of all that are alive. I am the mayfly metamorphosing on the surface of the river, and I am the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am the frog swimming happily in the clear pond, and I am also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am the child of Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I am a member of the Politburo with plenty of power in my hands. And I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people, dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom in all walks of life. My pain is a river of tears, so full it fills the four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can hear all my cries and laughs at once, so I can see that my joy and pain are one. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up, and so the door of my heart can be left open, the door of compassion. So meditation and awareness help us understand the causes and the conditions that are behind others' behavior and our own responses. They support us in replacing blame with compassionate understanding. So I wanted to read you another poem. This poet is a Palestinian poet, and it's from Nazareth. And he speaks of his intention to forgive in his poem, which is titled Revenge. At times, I wish I could meet in a duel the man who killed my father and raised our home, expelling me into a narrow country. And if he killed me, I'd rest at last. And if I were ready, I would take my revenge. But it came to light when my rival appeared that he had a mother waiting for him, or a father who'd put his right hand over his heart's place in his chest whenever his son was late, even by just a quarter hour, for a meeting they'd set, then I would not kill him, even if I could. Likewise, I would not murder him if it were soon made clear that he had a brother or sisters who loved him and constantly longed to see him, or if he had a wife to greet him and children who couldn't bear his absence and whom his gifts would thrill, or if he had friends or companions or neighbors he knew, or allies from prison or a hospital room, or classmates from his school asking him about him and sending him regards. But if he turned out to be on his own, cut off like a branch from a tree, without a mother or a father, with neither a brother nor a sister, wifeless, without a child, without kin or neighbors or friends, colleagues or companions, then I'd add nothing to his pain, to his pain within that aloneness, not the torment of death, and not the sorrow of passing away. Instead, I'd be content to ignore him when I passed him by on the street, and as I convinced myself that paying him no attention in itself was a kind of revenge. So I was what you might call a child of the 60s. I intentionally went to UC Berkeley because I thought that's where the action really was. And I had been raised by a family that was pretty patriotic. My father, as I think I told you the opening night, was a commander of a ship chasing submarines. But he was also somebody who named his son after Thomas Jefferson because he believed in freedom and tolerance, and he and my mother named me after Jane Addams, who actually was the first American woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize, and she was the first social worker, really, in America. So I really grew up with a passion for improving the world. And some people, when I talk to younger people these days, they get all kind of misty-eyed, and they say, oh, gee, I wish I were around in the 60s. It sounds like it was so much fun, and it was really vibrant and alive, but it was also really a painful time. This was the time of the bus boycotts, the sit-ins, the marches, the freedom rides, the stop the draft, the Martin Luther King was assassinated, and 2 months later, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. It was a really intense time, and I was involved in civil rights, and I was also involved in Stop the Draft. And at one point, I got kind of caught because my boyfriend's father was a public defender, and he said, don't worry, Jane, I've got you covered. Go ahead and get arrested, and I've got your bail covered, you know? And then there was my father, and he would call me up and say, hey, Jane, you know, I know you want to be a teacher, and I don't think they'll give you a teacher's credential if you get arrested. You know, so I was really torn, and my professors were mainly compassionate activists, and all the time, every day for lunch, we had one speaker after another, you know, telling us we should do this, we should do that. But it wasn't nearly as it wasn't as wise a movement then. It was a young movement, and we were young. We were young, we were passionate, somewhat brave, somewhat entitled, and impatient. And we had all been brought up on this sort of American mythology that turned out to be totally what we thought, very untrue. So I went to this demonstration, and my boyfriend's little brother was in it, and what people were doing was they were sitting in the street to stop the draft, and they had the authorities, the police came in with batons and they just cracked like this. They just went down the street and then they would drag people by their hair to the cars and put them in the cars and take them, police vans, and take them away. And I saw people with blood running down their face. And that happened actually to my boyfriend's little brother. And I just thought, I'm not doing this. This is not the way that I want to, you know, get arrested. But that was my side. And there was a whole place for us to be on the side watching. And we were sort of to let the police know that we were there. We were thousands, you know, there watching what they were doing. But then my side got really more and more furious and just kind of lost it and started yelling all sorts of things, including kill the pigs. And, you know, I didn't feel so good on that side either. You know, it was very, very uncomfortable for me. I can't tell you how much. And I remember just starting to cry. I was at the end of my rope. I was so confused and in despair. And I didn't know, you know, it just seemed awful. And so, you know, now it really makes sense to me what the Buddha said, that hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is an ancient and eternal law. And over time, I had to learn that power doesn't come from power over. Real power comes from being centered. That is the power that Martin Luther King showed us and so many different people showed us. So we were all in turmoil, and I had a favorite professor, Bernard Diamond, and he happened to have both a degree he was a doctor by training, a psychiatrist, and also a degree in law. And so he said, you know, what you guys need, he was out demonstrating also, but he said, you need perspective. You're getting caught in one event and you're thinking it will always be this way and this is not, you need to see the bigger picture. And so he told us the story of Earl Warren, which I thought I'd tell to you tonight. And many of you who are Californians probably already know it. But one of the ingredients of forgiveness is remorse, is when you realize that you've made a mistake and you really feel it in your body, you know your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, and you know that you have made a mistake, it is really important to apologize and to do what you can to rectify that mistake. So, the beginning of this story starts with World War II. Remember, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, and that drove everybody into shock and immediate action. And we had about 100,000 Japanese Americans living in Pacific Coast cities, and they were mostly kept segregated. They were not integrated very much, but they were incredibly law-abiding as a group. And about two-thirds of them were actually American citizens. But as soon as World War II broke out, Roosevelt, our president at the time, FDR, who said, okay, we're going to create relocation camps. We're going to round all Japanese Americans and all people of Japanese descent. We're going to round them up and put them in these camps to protect ourselves from them. And they very much resembled concentration camps. They were enclosed with barbed wire and they were patrolled by armed guards. But fortunately, there was no intention of killing or harming anyone, but of course, the psychological harm was quite intense. So, two of these Berkeley happens to be a center for Japanese Americans, one of the Pacific Coast cities. And actually, our next door neighbors, Fred and Carrie, were of Japanese descent. They were about the best neighbors you could possibly imagine. They were kind and warm and generous and fun and funny and welcoming. And he happened to be a very highly trained martial artist. So actually somebody came all the way from Japan to study with him. But when the war broke out, he and Carrie owned the biggest produce market in Hollywood. They were very proud of that. And then within a month, everything was taken away from all Japanese Americans. They were allowed to keep one suitcase, which they could take with them to the camp. So that happened to him. And then up the street from us, another neighbor and good Dharma friend was Bob. His family, he was a little boy when the war broke out, and his family was terrified of the idea of going to some kind of camp. They didn't know what was going to happen in these camps. And so they took their children and their camping gear and they camped out. For 8 months they camped out. And they finally got rounded up and sent to the camps. And then I was a teacher in Berkeley Public Schools, and one of my colleagues spent time in the camps, and she said it was just devastating to her family. So you could see, this was not a good thing. There's no way now that we could feel good about it. But Earl Warren at the time was the one that followed out the orders. He was the attorney general and later the governor who followed out the orders from Franklin Roosevelt to incarcerate people. And years later, Warren said that he deeply regretted his actions carrying out this removal order because he realized it was not in keeping with our American concept of freedom and the rights of citizens. And he was a father of six children, a very devoted family man, and he really felt his guilt. And he said, whenever I thought of all the innocent little children who were torn from their homes and their schools and their congenial surroundings, I was conscience-stricken. And so on reflection, he said, it was wrong to react so impulsively without positive evidence of disloyalty. Actually, they were some of the most law-abiding citizens we had. And he had to come to terms with his ethnic and racial stereotyping in his own thought, which had led him to participate, to carry out the orders. And as a Baptist minister, Reverend Welton Gaddy, said, forgiveness is not about wiping away consequences. Forgiveness is about creating possibilities. So when we fall out of integrity, that can serve as a springboard to make some more skillful choices in the future. And this process takes patience, kindness, clear intention, and change and real determination. So years later, Earl Warren became the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Excuse me. And that is when Warren wrote the court's unanimous decision in Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954 that racial segregation in public schools was based on stereotypes that were unfair, unequal, and offensive to American life. He emphatically stated that segregation failed to provide black and white children equal protection under the law, a protection guaranteed by the 14th Amendment, and that segregation was therefore deemed unconstitutional. So from Buddhist scriptures, the Dhammapada 173, we hear that people who recognize their mistakes and change their ways illuminate the world like the moon when freed from a cloud. So when we remember that a life well lived is the best way to get out of the prison of our minds, and that instead of focusing and ruminating on our wounded feelings, we learn to also balance that by looking for the love and the beauty and all the kindness around us, then forgiveness becomes a personal power. And you can amend your grievance story to remind yourself that you are the hero in your story, and you have the option to make the heroic choice to intend to forgive. So I wanted to end with a poem by Dana Faulds called Awakening Now. First, I'll take it. Why wait for your awakening? The moment your eyes are open, seize the day. Would you hold back when the beloved beckons? Would you deliver your litany of sins like a child's collection of seashells, prized and labeled? No, I can't step across the threshold, you say, eyes downcast. I'm not worthy. I'm afraid, and my motives aren't pure. I'm not perfect, and surely I haven't practiced nearly enough. My meditation isn't deep, and my prayers are sometimes insincere. I still chew my fingernails, and my refrigerator isn't clean. Do you value your reasons for staying small more than the light shining through the open door? Forgive yourself. Now is the only time you have to be whole. Now is the sole moment that exists to live in light of your true self. Perfection is not a prerequisite for anything but pain. Please, oh please, don't continue to believe in your disbelief. This is the day of your awakening. So let's just sit for a moment. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Now we have about, 20 minutes for walking? And then maybe come on back. Are you going to be the... Come on back for a little nightcap from James.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.